This episode is brought to you by Windrose Recovery, a family of premier addiction treatment programs in southeastern Wisconsin. Privately owned, Windrose Recovery offers a full continuum of personalized care for those struggling with addiction, including the Manor for residential treatment, Midwest Detox for inpatient detoxification, and Windrose Counseling for outpatient treatment. With highly personalized treatment focused on trauma, Dr. Chantal Thomas and her expert team offer an authentic experience, creating the kind of deep emotional change that's crucial for long-term recovery. If you or someone you love is struggling with addiction, call Windrose Recovery at 414-409-5300. You can learn more about Windrose Recovery by clicking the link in the show notes or by visiting WindroseRecovery.com. Thank you for listening to The Path to Authenticity. My name's Tom Gentry. I think of this show as the opposite of small talk. You'll hear real conversations with real people who know who they are. We talk about what makes them who they are, how they became who they are, and how we might become truer expressions of who we are.
This is Lucia Capaccioni, and this is The Path to Authenticity.
Deep in the Santa Monica Mountains, Her Escape Vortex offers a unique and truly fantastic setting for your next spiritual retreat. The Lavender Garden, the fire pit overlooking the Topanga Canyon sunset, and the Moroccan-furnished yurt on this magical property provide the atmosphere for an inspiring and transformative experience. A sacred place ideal for yoga and wellness retreats, as well as cleansing and healing ceremony of all kinds, Her Escape Vortex is part of a community of people eager for personal and spiritual growth. Visit thepathtoauthenticity.com/her-escape-vortex or click on the link in the show notes for more information. If this is your first time here, thanks for checking it out. If not, thanks for coming back. I'm Tom Gentry, and this is The Path to Authenticity, episode 143 for September 28th, 2021. It's part two of my conversation with Lucia Capaccioni. So, just want to keep you guys up to speed with what's going on with the podcast. I'm doing this room on Clubhouse at noon, Monday through Friday, called 20 Questions. It's where I have a guest and ask them 20 questions. If you've seen the blog posts where I've used this questionnaire with guests of the show, it's the same 20 questions, and it's pretty fun. So most days, Monday through Fridays, and more as time goes on, every Monday through Friday, I'll be doing that. And I'm recording those episodes. They're available on Patreon the following day, so patrons have access to those. Eventually, that might become a podcast of its own. Yeah, so things are going well. I'm excited. Again, I felt like I wanted to share this conversation with Lucia. What you will hear in this episode was originally in episode 5. I cleaned it up. And as I mentioned last week, these earlier episodes have been getting buried, so people aren't seeing them. And I felt like these conversations with Lucia were really significant in terms of the subject matter of the podcast. Inner child, authentic self. She talks about the critical voice, the critical parent, and she just has a fascinating story. I also want to remind you guys that I have this 8-week series of groups coming up called Path to Purpose. it's a great way for a handful of people who are interested in finding the life that they really want, connect and support each other. Anyway, I appreciate you guys listening. Enjoy my conversation with Lucia Capicchioni.
The roots of our creativity are in our inner child. You know, just watch children. Their sense of awe and wonder and experimentation and spontaneity, their playfulness, all of those qualities are what give juice to any creative project. And if that's missing, then forget it. It's going to be a chore. It's going to be boring. Nobody's going to want it. You know, it's just not going to have any pizzazz to it, no juice.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You know, another thing, conclusion that I've reached is, you know, life is really a lot, I believe at this point in my life, a lot more about unlearning than it is about learning, you know, because as children, we are pure and spontaneous and we know how to love, you know, we're not afraid to love. We have everything that we need, but then we're kind of groomed to be afraid and, you know, and life just kind of does a number on us. So it really is about recovering that and getting back to that and unlearning all these self-imposed limits.
And that's exactly why I titled the book Recovery of Your Inner Child, because that's really what it's all about. And it did not surprise me that it became a bestseller very quickly. And I think it was very much due to a readership among adult children of alcoholics. I got a lot of fan mail from that population saying that this book really did it for them. It really gave them the tool. It helped them to truly understand how they had lost their childhood and that they could get it back. And I was very gratified by that. I got lots of invitations by people who were members of ACA and put workshops together for me to lead. And I've done phone call conferences for ACA that a lot of people have heard, and they've contacted me to do private work or come to workshops or get more books because they were very helped by it. You see, for me, all addiction is caused by the inner child being gagged.
Yeah.
Yeah. So if you just imagine putting a gag in a child's mouth so that it won't speak, so that it won't be able to express itself, it won't be able to share its feelings. It won't even be able to feel its feelings. And so all addiction is an attempt to gag the true inner child's feelings and emotions and physical sensations. And of course that shuts down so much, and it shuts down our aliveness.
Mm-hmm.
And so it doesn't matter what the addiction is. It's just an attempt to distract us from the truth of what this inner child is trying to tell us. So to me, any recovery that doesn't address the inner child is going to be missing something major here.
Absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, the imagery that comes to my mind, for you, it's the inner child being gagged. For me, it's, you know, having a foot on his throat. Somebody has a foot on his throat,
mm-hmm.
you know, and it's really, I mean, it's so stifling. You know, we do even adapt our breath. We hold our breath differently and
exactly
swallow
and of course
our feelings.
It's a battle between the child and the critic.
Mm-hmm.
Because the critic is trying to keep the child under wraps and to keep shutting it up. So that critic is just ferocious. And I have had clients who had attempted suicide many times before they started working with me. And they've talked to me about how the inner critic told them to do it. You know, do yourself in. You're useless. You're worthless. You shouldn't be here. Mm. And it was so pernicious and so strong that they came very close to following those directives. But it was their own inner critic in their own head. And once they started doing this work, they could see that they could have that battle out on the pages of their journal and dialogue with that critic and not do harm to themselves or turn to an addiction, because many of them have been addicted as well. So, you know, I don't want to sound overly boastful, but I have had a lot of people tell me that this method saved their lives. And I'm going to have to take them on their word, because they were the ones that were struggling with life-threatening mental outlooks and life-threatening behaviors. And that's what they've told me. So I am really grateful if that has been the case.
Well, you know, I think maybe I see it as a little more indirectly for me, but you know, definitely my own recovery at the end of the day has been about, you know what, I deserve to be who I am.
Right.
You know, and I deserve that. We all deserve that. And
exactly.
And you know, I think to introduce another little twist to what we're talking about here, codependency in my world gets thrown around all the time, and it is for me sometimes a little bit of a pet peeve, because I feel like there are a lot of folks out there who don't really understand it, who actually suffer from it, yet they use it as a label for other people, which is really, really destructive, you know, and
exactly.
Shaming,
yeah.
You know, and so another book that has really helped me is Pia Melody's book, Facing Codependence, because she's really clear about identifying, you know, this is a real thing. There are five core symptoms. This is how it originates. This is how it begins to emerge. This is how it plays out. This is how you experience it as a child. This is how it manifests itself as an adult. And this is how you pass it on. And it's intergenerational.
Exactly. Well, it was that codependency piece that motivated me to really work on the other aspect of my inner family work, and that was the protective parent. Because in the beginning, I really focused on the nurturing parent within to help individuals learn to nurture themselves and to give to themselves. And that was a key and was very important. And to have that dialogue between the nurturing parent speaking with the dominant hand and the inner child with the non-dominant, and to interview the child, find out, you know, how do you feel and why do you feel that way and what do you need from me and all of that sort of dialogue. But more and more, I realized that we had to bring in a protective parent, which is a very different energy. It is very businesslike and very impersonal, and it has to be, in order to create boundaries and set limits. And that has literally saved some of my clients' lives who were in situations where they were being really taken advantage of, and they had not known how to stand up for themselves. And once they experienced, and I do voice dialogue work now, it's not Gestalt, it's sort of rooted in that, but in voice dialogue work that was developed by Helen Sidra Stone, who I trained with, in the voice dialogue work, I interview the members of the client's inner family, and I start with the protective parent, and I have them get up out of their, what we call the aware ego chair, which is kind of the director of the play of their life, and we talk to the protective parent, and I ask them to spontaneously find out where that protective parent feels most comfortable in the room. Sometimes their protective parent is out to lunch, and it'll be out in the hallway, won't even be in the room. Right. And that tells us a lot, too. But we find out where the protective parent is, and then I interview them as their protective parent. And that protective parent has its own identity, its own job to do, its own worldview. And its only job is to protect the inner child. That's it. So that means protecting the body, protecting the emotions, protecting the creativity and the spirituality of the inner child. And so I'll interview it, find out, you know, is it on the job or not? And if it isn't, what support does it need, et cetera? And their body posture and their tone of voice tells them and me everything about how their boundary setting and limit setting function is working. And we personify it through that protective parent. And they know that when they have to bring their protective parent in to set some boundaries, they're going to know what it feels like inside. They're going to know what their voice sounds like when they're speaking from that place.
Yeah, I mean, and that, this very vivid memories come up for me as you mentioned this, and I can feel it, you know, that energy. And for me, the way that that has emerged in my adult life is in the presence of bullies. Because, I had some bullies to contend with as a kid. And, you know, there were times as a kid when that protective parent showed up and put his foot down and said, this isn't happening anymore. And, you know, I had a conversation with somebody a couple years ago who was, you know, probably fits into that category as a bully. And I knew what I was getting into when I got into this relationship, and I knew the day would come when there was a reckoning when my protective parent said, you know what? I've watched you bully a lot of people. You're not going to bully me.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you know, I'm teaching this to young people now through a program that I developed for middle school and high school in our local schools here in Cambria, California. I've trained the teacher in my Creative Journal Expressive Arts certification training, and she has been working for 3 years now with these kids. And one of the workbooks we developed is called Life Skills Workbook for Teens. And I talk about the inner bully, and I give them these kinds of journal activities to do. And these kids love it. They really get it very quickly. We are doing the same thing in the high school with that same program, and we've also added a program called Talent to Work, which is a career development program where they identify and cultivate and learn how to market their natural talents so that we're getting them in the groove of listen to your heart, listen to what you really love to do, and follow that path, the path of the heart. Mm-hmm. And this is how they do it with this workbook. And the results so far have been really phenomenal. I cannot tell you how exciting it is to see these kids. It's a small town. There's just a few thousand people here. And I have these kids come up to me in the supermarket, at the post office, and all over town. And they'll say things to me like, you know, I had an inner critic attack the other day. And I could hear it in my head, and I just stopped, and I said to it, I didn't have my journal with me, but I just stopped and I said, you know what? Just shut up. Just shut up. And I felt so much better. And I say, you know what? I am just thrilled to hear that you're learning this at this age. Because a lot of people don't learn it till way late in life. And I said, here you are, 15, 16 years old, and you've learned this tool. And this is going to make your life a lot easier.
You know, I am fortunate enough to have experienced what you're talking about when, you know, there are these messages, kind of axes that I want to grind and that I repeat and repeat and repeat to clients. And for me, a big one is the idea that you don't talk about your feelings is, you know, there's nothing courageous about that. What's courageous is to be vulnerable. And this whole idea that as men, we're not supposed to experience our feelings or talk. It's just a crock of shit. It's succumbing to fear. And, you know, so that's something I talk with the guys that I work with. I talk about it a lot. And, you know, I had a situation a few months back where I was in this men's group where, you know, I had this 21-year-old kid with his arms crossed, shaking his head back and forth. It doesn't take any courage to bite your tongue. It takes courage to be vulnerable. And it made my heart sing that, you know, it's working, you know, it's working. at least to some degree. Right. So you mentioned your training and certification, the CJEA, which is Creative Journal Expressive Arts. Is that right?
Right, right. And that was born a little over 20 years ago in Canada. Marcia Nelson, who had been producing workshops for me abroad, she was also a travel agent, but she studied my work and came to a lot of workshops and was traveling with me. We were in Canada in Edmonton at a retreat center, and I was leading workshops every day for different audiences. Some people were coming back to different events, but they were individually marketed workshops with different topics for a whole week. And midweek, a bunch of these folks were coming up to Marcia during the break and saying, does she train professionals to do this work? And Marcia said, well, not so far. Well, we think she should. Would she consider doing that? And we'd sign up for something like that. Well, long story short, Marcia went out one day and printed up a brochure that I dictated to her and came back and passed it out. And 33 people said they wanted to take this training. And they didn't all end up taking it. But we did go back a year later, and we had half American folks from the U.S. and half Canadians. And we did our first week-long intensive in Creative Journal Expressive Arts training for professionals. That was in 1998. And then we had so much demand for the training. This was a year-long training that started with a week intensive, but then there was field work that Marcia ended up supervising. And they would have to go out and practice this. They'd have to read my books and so on and so forth, and then come back to an intensive a year later. And we have used that model ever since. We've been training people. Our first graduating class was in 1999 in California. And we have been doing this training ever since, and we've trained hundreds of people. We have 70-plus people right now who are actively teaching this in their own businesses around the world. And it's been quite a journey, and it's taught me a great deal about the applicability of the method, because we've worked with veterans, we've worked in prisons, we've worked with cancer patients in schools, in hospitals, you name it, corporations, in law enforcement. There has been no place that we haven't been able to take it so far. And it's been very exciting to develop these other programs, like, you know, programs in schools K through 12, and I've written manuals for those kinds of programs. So it's been quite an adventure, because these graduates are taking it places that I wouldn't be able to go because I haven't worked in those fields. But they have, and they're specialists. So we have one woman that's working in the eating disorder field and using my methods and getting fantastic results. She's a nutritionist, but she is using this method along with her nutritional guidance and just really turning some of these young people around.
Well, so you mentioned your work in the corporate world. Can we talk about that a little bit? Can you talk about
what
that's been like?
Yeah. Well, my first corporate work was really in my career as a designer, designing preschool educational toys at Mattel. So I had some experience working in a corporation. And then later on, when I started developing this work, my first book, The Creative Journal, got the attention of the talent development coordinator at Walt Disney Imagineering. That's the division that designs and builds the theme parks and the Disney retail stores. And she was very excited about my methods for working with the right brain and integrating and communicating between the right and the left brain. Because at Imagineering, as she described to me, they had a problem in a corporate sense, with what they called the left brain side of the house, and that was all of the, what they jokingly called the bean counters, the very structured left brain professions. and the right brainers, who were the artists and designers and model builders, and they didn't think the same way. They were not trained the same way. They had different values, and they communicated differently. And it was creating a lot of in-house communication difficulty, and she thought maybe I could help with that. So I came in, and I did a talk about the right and left brains in the early 80s, and I talked about using the non-dominant hand and all that. And that was it, one-shot gig. And then a couple years later, they brought me in when they were doing outplacement consulting for a lot of employees who were being laid off. After Epcot was completed and Tokyo Disneyland was finished, they didn't have much work. And so they laid most of their staff off, and it was quite a number of people. I think it was a couple of thousand. So they brought me in to help people who were needing to go out now and start their careers all over. But while I was doing that, I heard about what the problems were in-house, and I proposed a consulting series of 6 sessions to do some problem solving. And that led to 10 years wow. of consulting every week, one day a week, every Friday. I would go in and do workshops for managers and sometimes for a department if they were having a problem. And I did all of this kind of work, including voice dialogue, with them for 10 years. It was a really wonderful experience.
So, Lucia, what's it like for you to walk into a Disney store? What goes through your head?
I haven't been in one for a long time, but I did go to theme parks a lot because they gave me free tickets.
Mm-hmm.
And so I would take friends, I would take my grandkids, I would take my kids. So I spent a lot of time at the Disney park, and I was working with them when they were developing different attractions. So I got to really see the fruits of our labor
right.
when I'd go to the park, but I knew what the process was for getting there. And that gave me a whole different insight into those attractions. So it was very exciting. In fact, the Indiana Jones ride came out of a speech class that I was co-leading with a speech, public speaking instructor. And I was doing the storyline coaching with them because these artists had to present to people with lots of money who were going to invest in the park. And so the artists had to learn how to speak up and present themselves and their ideas and get these investors excited about their theme park ideas. And one of our students, as an assignment, just made up an Indiana Jones ride for the class and came in with a pith helmet and camouflage clothes and whole works.
Wow.
Did a fabulous presentation. And the woman who brought me in, when she heard her, she said, you've got to go pitch this to one of our show designers. This is really too good. This needs to be in the park.
Wow.
And that's how it happened. And it was sort of by accident. It was just a class assignment.
So amazing.
So yeah.
Are there other...
In fact, the idea for the Disney stores happened in one of my brainstorming groups. And I turned to them and I asked a question. And I said, where is your biggest profit center in the theme parks? And they said, the retail stores that sell the Disney products. And I said, well, can you export that? And the next thing I knew, they were opening a Disney store at the Glendale Galleria. And the rest is history.
Yeah. Yeah, I think now you're not there anymore. They've been closing some of those stores. There aren't as many of them. But so are there other big corporations that you've had your hands in over the years, Lucia? Where else?
It was mostly the Disney work, but then I did do work with other outplacement companies because word had spread that our outplacement program at Disney was very successful. We had a 95% employment rate. They either started their own companies or got jobs. And for a theme park entertainment industry, that's really saying something. So I then started working with outplacement companies, working with banks, and this was in the 80s and actually early 90s, banks, oil companies, a lot of cosmetic companies, different companies that were relocating and laying people off and that sort of thing. And so I did a lot of career counseling work with them, and that was very exciting. I wasn't always able to use all of my methods, but I integrated it into what we were doing and encouraged journaling and that sort of thing.
Hmm. What's this all been like for you, Lucia, to do this with your life?
Well, it's been a great blessing because I have worked with a lot of people, even people in their 60s and 70s, who never felt that they really found their path in life. And I've seen how distressful that was for them.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was because they, you know, talking earlier about not listening to their heart early on,
mm-hmm.
and they lost touch with what they really loved. Now, in coming into my work, many of them did find, finally, what their true love was, and they followed it. They got their critic out of the way, and they went for it. But I'm so grateful that whatever I did, even before I got into art therapy, my heart was always in it, and I always loved doing it. And in looking back, I see how my art career, my early childhood career, was all preparing me for my true life's work, which was all of this creative journal and expressive arts therapies applied to all these different, you know, populations. And I feel very grateful that I was given this work to do. I did a dialogue in my journal one time, and I asked my higher power, you know, why did you give me this work to do? And the answer was, because you volunteered. So, and I did indeed volunteer because I saw that it saved my life, and I wanted to share it with others. That was my real motivation. There was no question. And by the way, the condition I had in 73 when I felt that I was going to die turned out to be correctly diagnosed a few years later by a man who was a pioneer in what is called sclerology. It's similar to iridology, which is an ancient Chinese diagnostic method. Sclerology is the reading of the whites of the eyes. And this particular man, Dr. Wheelwright, developed this method of diagnosis, and he happened to be traveling through L.A., and a friend, I didn't know anything about him at the time, and he wasn't well known then, but a friend of mine said, you know, this man can diagnose things that you had years back, and you never did find out what you had, so you want to meet with him. So I did, and I met with him for a very short time, maybe 15 minutes, and he started out by reading my whole health history, and he was totally accurate. He told me how old I was when I had pneumonia. He told me how old I was when I had a serious case of bronchitis. And I mean, it was as if he had my health history in front of him. And he told me he could tell that by looking at my eyes. And then he said, what happened when you were 35? Did you come unglued? And I just, it took my breath away. I said, well, that's the exact perfect description of what happened. I said, and I have journal drawings showing me literally coming apart, falling apart. And he said, well, you had a collagen disease, and collagen's the glue that holds everything together.
Oh my gosh.
And I was just blown away. And he said, but you don't have it anymore. What did you do? How did you turn it around? And I told him about the journaling and the drawing and art therapy and all that. And he said, well, that saved your life, because if you had continued taking medication, your immune system would have been completely wiped out and you would not have survived. And I told him about throwing all the medicine away and everything. So, yeah, that saved your life.
Wow. So it saved your life, and it has saved other lives.
The thing that taught me was how exquisitely accurate the art therapy art from the unconscious is, because I had so much art in my journal that described exactly what he had said. I had come unglued. Mm-hmm. I had had 5 years of crisis. My parents separated. My divorce ended. My husband was my business partner, so the business ended. I mean, everything fell apart. And then my body fell apart last. And so that whole metaphor of coming unglued was absolutely perfect. It was right on. And he said to me, yeah, that's what was happening in your body.
It's amazing.
So, you know, it just really, it reinforced what I had seen over and over with clients, that the unconscious, either in the dream state or in the spontaneous drawing process in the journal or in art therapy, reveals truths that we simply will never get to with our left linear logical brain. We just won't get there.
Well, and all of this brings me to the conclusion that I've made, which is, and I haven't quite wrapped my head around it completely yet. I have a lot to learn, but we all have what we need to heal within us. We have it already.
That's right. That's right.
So what are you going to do next, Lucia? What's on your life agenda these days?
Well, I am continuing with my trainings. I had developed another training called Visioning Coach Training. And so graduates of my CJEA program qualify for Visioning Coach Training because they have the tools that we need for visioning coaching based on the visioning book. And what I have been doing more recently is taking my graduates in depth into other trainings and working with the knowing field, where people are intuitively coming to an understanding of what they need to do. I've been doing training in Bert Hellinger's work. I did about 10 years ago, I trained with people who had trained with him in Germany, and he developed family constellations work where you do family healing by having individuals represent family members.
Mm-hmm.
And then they spontaneously bring forth truths and traumas that have happened in the family that have impacted the client today.
Mm-hmm.
And that was very profound work. And so what I've done is extracted a piece of that training, which is called color field therapy, in which individuals, like the client, will be guided to put down colored mats on the floor made of a kind of a, it's a plastic surface that they sell in art supply stores. It's a, kind of the size of a placemat. And they would put these colored mats on the floor and then stand on a mat that represents a goal or a desired outcome, and a mat for where they're at now. And then we look at mats for obstacles and for resources that will help them get to their goal. And that's just one format of working with mats and color field therapy. And it's very powerful. The results tend to be very quick. And I am developing that more and more. I am giving some thought to actually writing a book about that method, although I didn't originate it. I've been developing it and expanding on it. And it ties in beautifully with the art therapy work and with all the other work I do. It's very somatic because when people are standing on one of these mats, they actually feel, for instance, we use it with visioning. If we put a mat down that represents their collage, their visioning collage, and we ask them to stand in it, and we fast forward them, okay, you're in the future. Your dream's already come true. What's it like? And they actually somatize that. They feel it. And they'll talk about it. I feel liberated. I feel so free. And I feel like I could just fly, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Or I feel really satisfied. I feel really peaceful. Whatever it is. And then when they're working with the obstacles and the resources on mats, they're somatizing those as well. And they're getting clearer about what their obstacles are. How does it feel in their body when they feel blocked? And how does it feel in the body when they feel strong and they're moving through that block? And so more and more I'm moving toward a more somatic approach to art therapy, to visioning, to having people actually feel it in their body. I've been doing a lot of trauma release work in recent years, and same thing, really releasing trauma from the body. So I personally feel that the two cutting edge areas in therapies and healing are somatic therapies and work with the knowing field, where you use something like the non-dominant hand to tap into, let's say, another person's feelings about something, where you can dialogue with a relationship and heal it by dialoguing with the other person writing through your non-dominant hand. This is all based on Lynn McTaggart's work about the knowing field, that there is information that we can access through these various techniques. And those are the techniques that I'm really working on now.
One thing that comes to mind that I want to ask you about and get your response to, being someone who's worked, you know, specifically in the addiction treatment field for couple decades now, and being exposed to a lot of different programming, I have had occasion to hear some scorn about the inner child, and I've heard people say things like, if you're looking to do inner child work, this isn't the place for you, in a very boastful sort of way, like it's all a bunch of BS or something, you know?
Right.
So what do you say to that
person? I've heard that. Yeah, I've heard that, and where I think that's coming from is when inner child work was done without full understanding of the inner family. What I saw in the 80s and early 90s were people out in public with their teddy bears and that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And they were acting out their inner child in inappropriate places. I think the negative response that some people have had to inner child work is that they've observed the consequences of people doing inner child work that was incomplete. To me, there's no inner child work without doing inner family work. And so that's what I call it now. If the inner child does not also have a self-nurturing, but also a protective parent, then the work is incomplete. And I think what happened when the inner child movement really took off was a lot of people got little pieces of techniques from here and there, and they got stuck in their inner child. The inner parents were not really there. So they would act out in a very childish way. Mm-hmm. And so instead of really honoring the inner child, but also having this protective parent to be appropriate with when and how the inner child is being expressed, the child would just come out and then, of course, behave in socially inappropriate ways or ways that appeared very selfish. Oh, well, I'm just this, you know, I'm in my inner child and you just don't understand me. Right. And they're behaving badly. They're behaving like brats. Well, and so it really put a lot of people off. And I understand it because I've encountered a few of these in my day.
Well, it's funny because I was doing a group maybe about a year and a half ago. And it was with a guy who he'd had some pretty good treatment, you know, and learned to identify when he was being triggered. And we're having this interaction where he became reactive and, you know, sort of, you don't understand, you're triggering me. At which point I explained to him that, you know, the entire benefit of having that, that insight is that you can change the behavior and you don't have to react the way that exactly. You did before. So it's not my fault. You know, you're having a reaction. And I will not accept responsibility for that.
Exactly. Now, here's a wonderful example of one of my clients who's told me I can tell this story. It's an early client of mine. She was doing inner child work with me, and she was at work. And she called me from work on a payphone out in the hallway, and she's sort of whispering in the phone. She doesn't want anybody to hear her. And she, this is a long time ago. And so she said, my boss is acting horrible. We're short-staffed. And he's acting like a tyrant. And I'm ready to go in there and quit. And but I can't yet because I've not through with school. She was planning to be a teacher. She was just about to graduate, but she couldn't quit yet. And she needed the job. And I said, okay, do you have your journal with you? I knew she had it wherever she went. Yeah, it's in the car. I said, okay, can you take a break, get your journal, go to the restroom, and go in there and just have your temper tantrum in there in your journal. Scribble, just sit in a stall and scribble it out. Call him all the names in the book and anything you'd like to say to him and just scribble it out in your journal. And she said, oh, like taking a good shit. I said, exactly.
Oh my gosh.
So she did that. And she went in and just dumped it all out. She called me back that night and she said, thank you. Thank you, thank you. She said, you know, in the past, I would have gone in there and quit. But I didn't want to do that. And I said, well, no, you've got this other tool now.
Mm-hmm.
So you can do all your reacting in a private place that's safe, but you don't need to be run by your inner child. And this is what the aware ego is about. It's learning to go into the director's chair and say, okay, which of these actors do I want on the stage right now?
Mm-hmm.
Given what my values and what my goals are and what I hope to accomplish here, which character comes out now? And so then you're in charge of your life. Otherwise, these sub-personalities take over,
right.
And you don't want that. And she really got the message. So that's what bringing in the entire inner family construct is all about.
Mm-hmm.
It's like having the aware ego and being able to decide who's going to come out now.
Well, and I think the other part of that, going back to the scorn thing, is that, you know, people do that with things they don't really understand. And if you don't bother to learn that it's not only an inner child, it's an inner family, and they're actually real clear directives of how you can use these tools to manage your behavior in a different way, it's really, really useful.
Exactly.
I'll tell you another thing that I've gotten into the habit of doing often when I have the presence of mind is, you know, especially with, you know, I think we see so many people who just don't have the language of feelings. You know, they don't have what I call emotional literacy. So,
right.
You know, one of the things I will do with guys is say, how old do you feel right now? And then if they can put it, they can put an age on it, you know, it gets a little closer to what this feeling might be related to and what it actually is that they're feeling, you know?
Yeah. I use the term too. I love it. Emotional literacy.
Mm-hmm.
Because that is what I'm doing, is teaching people to use the language of emotions. And of course, the arts are one of the quintessential languages of emotions. That's what they're all about. So that's why the arts, therapies, expressive arts, all of it, movement, music, writing, the art, play, all of the media are just fabulous for helping people get in touch with their feelings, because that's what the arts are all about.
Well, you know, for me, this type of work, one of the things that helped me realize is, think about the polarities of life. You know, if you can't experience sadness, then how can you really know joy? And, you know,
Golda Meir said that.
Yeah.
She said that he who cannot cry with their whole heart cannot laugh either.
Right. And exactly. So when the gag is in the inner child's mouth or the foot is on his throat, you know, and he can't let out what he needs to let out, and he learns to numb himself and not feel that sadness of not being able to be who he is, then that also, it applies to the happy things in life too. You numb yourself mm-hmm. to all of it. And yeah, and then, exactly, you know, there's another term you hear in ACA a lot, with frozen feelings, which is, you know, kind of likened to an iceberg, which, you know, you can see a third of it over the surface of the water, but, you know, most of what's frozen is deep underneath and has to be excavated and experienced, exactly, really, you know. And so,
exactly. Now, one of the things that I find is really helpful is that we are using art materials that people used when they were children. Mm-hmm. A lot of my clients have not had a Crayola in their hands, right, since they were in kindergarten,
right,
or first grade. So the minute they pick up these art materials or working with clay, they regress. They really, mm-hmm, go back to those memories. And that's exactly what I want them to do, to be able to go to that original state that they were in when they were young children, which has the spontaneity and the creativity in it. And to me, that's where we want to go. We want to, mm-hmm, find the playful and the creative and the spiritual child. And those are the three last chapters of my book, Recovery of the Inner Child. We can really embrace those aspects of the inner child once we've been through the vulnerable child, the child that's afraid, that's very hurt, or the angry child that's in a rage, you know, going through all of that and embracing it and healing it then enables us to really come to a kind of vitality through this playful, creative, and spiritual child that we have not known before. And it's always incredibly, just moving for me to see people arrive at that healthy state of the inner child and be able to embrace that. You know, not that the vulnerability and the anger and all the other stuff are going to go away. They're not. To be human is to have those feelings. Mm-hmm. But at least we know now that it's okay to embrace them, to feel them, to express them in a safe place, and then move on.
Well, I know for me, when I sit down with the crayon and a notebook, and I start to write with my left hand, man, I feel frustration immediately.
Right.
It feels awkward, right, in my hand. You know, I can write with my right hand, but, you know, this just feels so awkward. And then not to mention the fact that I can't do this anywhere near as quickly with my left hand, as so my hand's trying to catch up with my brain, and, you know, and eventually I switch to a Sharpie or a pen. And then eventually, you know, when I know I'm tapped in enough, for me, what I've done is just go ahead and use my right hand so I can catch up. And
Well, you know, that's the great value of the non-dominant hand. We haven't talked too much about how it accesses the right brain, which is the road into the limbic system where the emotions are stored. There is no direct path from the left brain into the limbic system, but there is through the right brain. So we go in through right brain activities that are nonverbal, that are visual, that are kinesthetic, and we also tap into areas of the right brain that have to do with sensory awareness. And so that feeling of vulnerability when we're using the non-dominant hand is a beautiful example of how it feels to be vulnerable. Mm-hmm. And when we're in that state, then we can work with it.
Right.
And you were talking about especially men who are told never to be vulnerable.
Right.
This is a great test. This is a great way for them to really, you know, look at vulnerability and experience it head on right there while they're using that hand. The other thing I tell people is that in our society, we need to learn how to slow down.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole practice of mindfulness is about that. And so a lot of people who teach mindfulness are using my method as well now, because they say that when people are writing or drawing with their non-dominant hand, they have to slow down.
Yeah.
And they have to pay attention to what's going on the page in this moment, and not rush ahead to what they want to accomplish on the page. But just, what's it like for my hand to be moving on this piece of paper and making this red mark with this red Crayola today? And what does it smell like? Oh, it's I can smell the crayon, right? And so they, and then, oh, well, what if I make a mark that goes in this direction? Or what if I press harder? Mm-hmm. So now they're in their senses, and this is where I want to take people. I want them in the moment, in the senses, and that's where the inner child lives. And so it is exactly the reason why these materials are so valuable, because they do put us in touch with our vulnerability. They take us out of control. But if we'll experiment with it and, like, do some scribbling and have fun with it, it can then flip us over into the playful child, which is the part that doesn't know everything. It's exploring. It's experimenting. And that's a childlike state that we really want to get to. That's creative. You know, just where we don't have any goal in mind. We're just, you know, fooling around with the colors on the paper. What does it look like? You know, it's a whole different state of mind. And that's one thing that my method really does help people to do. I have a book called The Art of Emotional Healing. And that is a book that covers all the expressive arts therapies with music and movement and storytelling and working with clay and two-dimensional art and writing. And I've gotten wonderful feedback from people who had the same issue that you described before they picked up that book. And when they started just scribbling with their non-dominant hand and just paying attention to the sensory experience of it, they started to get through and out from under the thumb of the critic who was telling them, oh, hurry up, and this is horrible handwriting, and you should do this, and why are you doing that, and this is a waste of paper, and so on and so forth. So I've been really glad to get that feedback that, you know, they've been able to slow themselves down and just have the sensory experience of making marks on a piece of paper, leaving tracks of color. And I recommend people put music on so that they get even further away from their left brain and to draw to music. It's like, you know, ice skaters leaving tracks on the ice. Mm-hmm. It's just, you know, literally dancing on paper and using the music as a soundtrack for that. And using both hands as well. Yeah, it really is relaxing. I have a couple of coloring books that I published a couple of years ago in which I introduced that idea. One of them is called Drawing Your Stress Away, and the other one is Hello, This Is Your Body Talking, where you do dialogues with your body. But there's a lot of scribbling that happens in those. There's paper in the actual workbook to do the drawing on. And a lot of people just warm up with scribbles. And they, at first, they balk at it, but once they start doing it, they really have fun. They really like it.
That's great. Well, Lucia, you know, I love talking to you. I could go on and on. There an endless number.
Well, this has been
topics,
a real treat. Really, yeah, has. And, yeah. And I really enjoyed it.
Me too. And I just want to tell you that when I think about the path, the course that my life has taken, and, you know, my own personal recovery and metamorphosis, you know, I mean, you know, I'm a kid from a relatively small town in Indiana where, you know, the Lucia Capicchionis of the world don't tend to show up. And I'm so grateful for the brilliant, gifted people who I've been able to meet throughout the course of my career. And there are a couple people at the top of that list who I think of when I'm in that frame of mind, and you're one of them.
And, well, thank
and,
you.
And the other one's in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame three times over. So that's pretty good company. You know,
I would say so.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I hope you've enjoyed this as much as I have. And again,
I have, it's been a treat. Yeah,
I
really
can't thank you enough. And I guess if I could ask you one more question before we close, for the lay person out there who's never stepped foot in a therapist's office, who knows nothing about the self-help movement, how can they benefit from inner child work? What is something simple that they can do to improve the quality of their life?
Well, they can actually do one of these dialogues with their inner child. I would suggest that they use their non-dominant hand to draw a picture that from their inner child, whatever that turns out to be. I have no idea what it would be, but it doesn't matter. And then to ask four questions. Who are you? and let the child answer with the non-dominant hand. How do you feel? Why do you feel that way? And what can I do for you? Those would be the four questions. Who are you? How do you feel? Why do you feel that way? And what can I do for you? And let that child speak with the non-dominant hand through printing or whatever form of writing, but it has to be done on paper. And I think that if they are willing to ask those questions and see what kind of answers they get, they'll have an experience of what we're talking about. And of course, if they want to do more in that realm, then they can get one of my books. I would recommend Recovery of Your Inner Child as a good place to start, or The Power of Your Other Hand.
Well, you're answering my next questions before I even asked them, so that's a good place to stop. Well, thank you so much, Lucia, again.
Thank you, Tom.
And we'll talk again soon, okay?
Yes, definitely. Please stay in touch. Thanks.
Authenticity proudly supports the iSpeak Media Foundation, advancing media literacy education through an evolving series of outreach programs within the communities that need it most. For more information, visit iSpeakMedia.org. There you go, Lucia Capicchione. Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed the episode, please share it with somebody. Maybe even leave a review or a rating on Apple Podcasts. That would be a big help. If you're on Clubhouse, check out my rooms. If you're not, there's a link in the show notes where you can join. It's one of those things when I've spoken to people about it, if they don't know anything about it, they think it's weird. But as soon as they go on the app, they get it. So it's worth a shot. If you have questions or comments, you can call and leave a voice message at 561-247-4757. I'd love to hear from you. Value any feedback you have to offer. And again, please support the show on Patreon. More and more, I'm spending time on this podcast and other content I'm creating. Every little bit helps me to devote more time to this kind of work. So if you appreciate what I'm doing and you can help, I'd appreciate it. I want to thank the show's sponsors, The Manor and Windrose Recovery, Her Escape Vortex. I want to thank the band Punk Rock Opera, whose music you hear throughout the show. Their songs are used with permission from the artist and under a Creative Commons license. Thank you to Wendy Chin with Equivox. And as always, The Path to Authenticity is proud to support the iSpeak Media Foundation. All right, got some great shows coming up here. Couple therapists, have a sex coach, sexual embodiment coach named Yulia Rose. Did that interview live on Clubhouse, and it was a lot of fun. That one's going to be a cool episode. So I appreciate you guys investing your time in the show. I hope you enjoyed these conversations with Lucia. I'm hoping to have more with her in the very near future. Maybe get her on Clubhouse. So, please keep coming back. Check out the website, thepathtoauthenticity.com. We have playlists on Spotify. Like us on Facebook. Follow us on Instagram. Hope you guys have a great week. Thanks again. Be nice.
Player.
This episode was brought to you by Equivox. For digital marketing or web design services, visit Equivox.com.